coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Morality in a godless world.
I thought God gave us moral order.
There's no moral order as pure as this storm. There's no moral order at all. There's just this. Can my violence conquer yours?
Philosophers don't agree on a basis for morality.
Theologians haven't found any good arguments for a morality determined by God.
The Hubble telescope hasn't found any source of right and wrong in the universe.
So why isn't morality just sanctimonious hokum?
I think this view of morality as objective just doesn't make sense.
Our guest is John Figner, co-author of Atheist Mind, Humanist Heart, Rewriting the Ten Commandments for the 21st Century.
People have broadly aligned interests. We don't have to believe that there's one right answer to think that some answers are better than others.
If there really is no morality, how can it be wrong to teach people that there is?
Morality in a godless world.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Annenberg Auditorium on the Stanford University campus.
Our thinking starts a stone's throw away over at Philosopher's Corner on the Quad. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 years.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, it's morality in a godless world.
Well, Ken, there may or there may not be a God, but there's definitely morality. So I guess that settles it. What's the big deal?
Well, haven't you read your Dostoevsky? He says, if God is dead, then everything is permitted. Well, that means there's no distinction between right and wrong, and thus no morality.
But Dostoevsky's dead, whether God is dead or not. Philosophers all over the world, be they utilitarians or Kantians or Rawlsians or whatever, teach courses in ethics. They don't rely on God. They don't mention God. They disagree with Dostoevsky. They feel no need whatsoever to appeal to God in trying to understand the nature of morality.
Well, look, I'm not going to say they're wrong necessarily. I'm just saying that once you give up on God, it's a lot harder to establish morality, especially an objective, absolute morality, than you might think, John.
Well, of course it's hard. That's why there are so many different ethical theories. That's why we pay ethics professors the big bucks. But the idea of God, that doesn't help at all.
Oh, I don't know, John. I don't know. Look, if there were a God, especially a perfect, all-loving, all-knowing God, wouldn't his word automatically just be the moral law?
Well, ask yourself this, Ken. Is murder wrong because God prohibits it? Or does God prohibit it because it's wrong?
You're trying to trap me on the horns of a dilemma, a centuries-old dilemma.
Exactly. It goes back to Plato's Euthyphro. If the theist says that God prohibits murder because it's independently wrong, then what does God will have to do with making it wrong? If the theist says it's wrong only because God forbids it, that makes it sound like there's nothing intrinsically wrong with murder until God arbitrarily decided to forbid it.
Well, you and Plato, you've got a point. I admit that. But look, every secular approach is just as badly off. Maybe even worse off. They don't come close to explaining where absolute objective moral truths might come from. The idea of God, well, at least it gives us a fighting chance at that.
Why? Why should I care about God's arbitrary moral pronouncements any more than I care about yours? Which, by the way, I don't.
Well, okay, because God is special. He's not some random stranger trying to make his way home. He's the creator of the universe, dude. He's the source of all truth.
If he's the creator of the universe, I must say he's made a bit of a mess of things. Why should I bow to his supposed authority?
Well, because he's God. Come on. And I got to warn you that as God, he gets to dole out the sweetest carrots and he wields the biggest stick.
Carrots and sticks, huh? Well, even divine might doesn't make right.
Okay, look, let's try it the other way. Consider a secular morality for a minute. Take utilitarianism. Always try to do the greatest good for the greatest number. Well, I'm going to ask you a question. Why should I care about the good of the greatest number? What authority, except maybe power, do they have over me?
Well, what are you, some kind of self-centered egomaniac? I mean, you don't care about the humanity, the largest number, all those people you're affecting?
I'm not saying that. I just refuse to be a mere instrument of what Nietzsche called the human herd. I refuse to let the human herd, with its incessant, insatiable demands, just rule over me. That's what I'm saying.
Nietzsche? Dostoevsky? You know, just because a guy's name is hard to spell doesn't give him any special authority. I mean, it's too easy to pick on utilitarianism. Okay, let's think about someone like Kant.
Well, Kant, yeah, he's no easy mark, but you know what he really wanted? He really wanted to get God in the picture. But he couldn't find a philosophically honest way of doing it, so you know what he did? He smuggled him in through the back door. That's what he did.
Well, that's a pretty strange critique of pure Kant.
No, well, think about his categorical imperative. What is it? It's an absolute, inescapable command binding on every rational person, supposedly, independently of their desires or inclinations or anything else about them.
Well, Ken, when you put it that way, you have a point. It sounds like a divine command theory without the divine commander.
Except, right, that's the trick. It's supposed to be human reason that delivers this thing.
So you don't believe in the categorical imperative.
Oh, God, it would be comforting. It would be really comforting to believe that we don't need to heed the far-off voice of a transcendent God. We can rely solely on the clear, unequivocal, authoritative voice of human reason to guide us. So comforting. But you know what? Pure fantasy. History gives a lie to Kant's fantasy. Reason, whatever that is, it's muted and confused. It speaks in many voices, not one. It produces a cacophony, not a symphony like Kant imagined.
You sound very much like a Nietzschean moral skeptic.
I just think that secular philosophers who believe in absolute morality are way too smug and self-confident about their ability to explain where that morality comes from. Smug and self-confident.
Well, I'm not convinced that they are, but in the spirit of openness, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, in search of further arguments for the idea that there's no morality without God. She files this report.
Earlier this year, the chancellor of Troy University in Alabama sent a little email to his 30,000 students. It said, and I paraphrase, "Happy New Year, everyone! Oh, and now that you're reading this, here's a link to a video saying that atheism leads to moral decay."
Where are the institutions that are going to teach the next generation of Americans that they, too, need to voluntarily choose to obey the laws? Because if you take away religion, you can't hire enough police.
That video didn't go over too well with a lot of the atheist students, and Troy is a public university. And it's not just godless folk who disagree with the video. This pastor also thinks it's a bit much.
I get what the guy's saying. I think for the most part he's right. I wouldn't say you got to believe in God to be a good person.
That's Rick Henderson, an evangelical Christian pastor from Utah. He says he knows a lot of moral atheists. But without God, their morality is just a collection of shared ideas and beliefs. Nothing more than a social contract. If there is a real objective standard of good, it has to be grounded in something outside the self.
People could certainly have a subjective moral standard. That's fine. But we just need to be honest with ourselves about what goes along with that. There is no value difference between the opinions of people from the NAACP, the KKK, ISIS, the ACLU, or Westboro Baptist Church. They are all the same.
Henderson's not alone. A lot of famous folks in history think the same thing. There's philosophers like Kierkegaard and Sartre, authors like Albert Camus and Stephen Jay Gould.
I've just read on and on and on, and these guys are saying there is no objective moral truth, there is no objective meaning if there is no God. And I take these guys seriously.
C.S. Lewis was also a big God advocate.
C.S. Lewis said this: if there is no answers, if there is no creator, if there is nothing that is really true, when you are in love, you must remember that only a pharmacological reaction in your brain is happening. There's no such thing as love. beauty and ugliness, cruelty and compassion are totally subjective, not real, all in my brain synapses.
What C.S. Lewis and Pastor Rick are saying is this: if it's all just biological, if it's just based on nature, then everything we feel is an illusion. Henderson thinks it's funny that so many people he knows reject God, but adamantly argue that meaning is real, that purpose is real, and that their moral values are real.
But it's just pretending. It's a delusion. It's only real if it's based in something that rises above my opinions, my society, my religion, my philosophy, whatever. And any thoughts that I have are just a product of what's happening in my brain, and it's subjective. It's not really true.
So are all the godless people out there living in a delusional reality if they believe in a real right and wrong? Pastor Rick thinks so. But there's one guy who disagrees. John Figder, a humanist chaplain at Stanford University. He's going to tell John and Ken why you don't need God to live a moral life. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thank you, Shuka, for that very interesting piece. I'm here along with my fellow philosopher at Stanford, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Annenberg Auditorium on the farm.
Our guest today is a humanist chaplain here at Stanford. He's co-author of Atheist Mind, Humanist Heart, Rewriting the Ten Commandments for the 21st Century. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, John Figder.
John, you're an advisor to atheists, humanists, and agnostics at Stanford. You are a humanist chaplain. Sounds like an oxymoron, or maybe a Stanfemoron. Tell me, what does a humanist chaplain do?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm a huge fan of both of you gentlemen. Now, to answer your question, humanist chaplains do three main things on campus. The first thing we do is provide counseling for students on campus and advocate for the non-religious perspective from within the office of religious life. This guarantees that atheists, humanists, agnostics have a seat at the table. The second thing that I do is host large public events with people like Richard Dawkins or Greta Christina, trying to educate the campus about atheism, humanism, non-religious belief. And then the last thing that I do is host service projects and organize my community to do blood drives and bone marrow drives and park cleanups and other charitable
events. But now, before we get to a substantive question here, why does an atheist humanist chaplain want a seat at the religious table? I mean, why are you part of the office of religious life?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that if they're going to be designing programs for religious students, they should keep in mind all the students who are opposed to some of those programs and who have a different perspective. And I think it makes sense that if we're going to have secular Buddhist students and we're going to have Zen Buddhists in the same category that we have Southern Baptists and Mormons, this category of religion isn't really picking out anything coherent. It's just a word that means people who have beliefs.
But now, John, many people think maybe atheism is true, maybe it's not true, but if it is true, there's no God. If there's no God, there's no absolute and objective morality. How do you deal with that? Do you think there's anything at all to that thought?
No, I think that's actually correct. There is no such thing as objective morality. Instead, what we have is morality from a subjective perspective.
So you agree with that Christian pastor on that on a roving report that it's all subjective if there is no God. God is the only possible source of objective morality. Not all philosophers agree with you.
Right. And I don't think God's the only source of objective morality, but I just don't believe that there is an objective basis for morality.
Oh, you believe that independently of being an atheist.
Exactly.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Annenberg Auditorium at Stanford. Our guest is John Figder, a humanist chaplain here at the university.
In our next segment, we'll dig into the challenge of basing morality on merely secular, human, or natural foundations. How far can we get with that approach? Can it deliver one true objective morality? Or does it condemn us to swim in the murky swamp of moral relativism?
Secular morality, absolute or relative, along with questions from our highly moral audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
If there's a rock and roll heaven, well, you know they got a hell of a band.
Thanks to our musical guest, the Playtones, reminding us of the joys that await us in heaven. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is John Figner. He's a humanist chaplain here at Stanford. He's co-author of Atheist Mind, Humanist Heart, Rewriting the Ten Commandments for the 21st Century.
If you were to rewrite the Ten Commandments for the 21st century, how would they look? Does each historical period and each distinct society have its own set of moral commandments? Or is there a single set of moral truths that are fixed once and for all? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphones.
So John, you reject the divine as a source of morality. So where do you think morality comes from?
So I think morality is a matter of human creation. It's something that we've imposed on the world. I think this view of morality as objective just doesn't make sense. For starters, look, what are we doing when we talk about morality? We're talking about what people do and don't want to have happen to them. Well, what is that other than people's opinions about what they do and don't want to have happen to them?
No, there's a lot more.
The data is subjective.
Well, wait a minute. I want lots of things. I want this drink of water right now. I want $1 million. Morality isn't just about what I want. This is pretending. I might want to bash you on the head for that answer. I don't want to, but I might want to.
Sure.
But it's not about what I want. It's about what I'm entitled to, what I have a right to do, what I ought to do. So it's not just the facts about my desires. Morality is not just that. You might want to shoot me, but there's some kind of normative prohibition on your shooting me. So it's not just a matter of want.
Yeah, I would guess all of us don't want to be shot, and I would guess that if we really introspected about the reason why we don't want this, it's because we don't want to be shot, bluntly. The thing that informs our moral perspective...
You might want to shoot me, but you don't have any right or entitlement to
shoot me. I don't,
my
dear sir.
Well, I know. And we're pretending right now.
Well, we shoot a lot of people, and there's a lot of opinions about when it's okay. But let's take a case. Let's take an innocent child, year-old child. Somebody's torturing that child. I don't want to go into detail, but really torturing them.
Okay. You know?
Making them cry out miserably in pain and maybe doing them physical injury too. That's wrong.
Of course.
Well, what do you mean, of course?
So it's wrong from a subjective
perspective. That seems to me about as objectively wrong as something could possibly be. It's just wrong. If somebody says, well, my opinion is that it isn't wrong, well, I say, well, your opinion is wrong.
So that's an interesting view. I just don't think it holds up. I think at heart what we're talking about is what people want to have happen to them, what they're trying to avoid in this case. And what you're pointing out is that people don't have a right to just demand that people follow their system. But just because everyone has their own perspective on what is moral doesn't mean all opinions are equally good. For example,
opinion other than mine isn't.
Right.
Any good. I mean, do you think the opinion that it's okay to torture innocent children is okay?
No, absolutely
not.
And I think the reason that we can have a discussion about this is we can talk about the consequences that stem from torturing a child. You would say, look, I like to torture a kid because it gives me this happiness. I would say, yeah, but we're going to cause an enormous amount of psychological damage for this kid. He's going to need therapy for the rest of his life. Why don't we instead not do that? And we can make the case. The point is that we don't have to believe that there's one right answer to think that some answers are better than others. I give this example of a cookie, where just because we can't agree that there's one perfect cookie recipe doesn't mean that all recipes are equally good. Chocolate chips are better than broccoli and sardines in a cookie.
Well, I grant you that, but I think you're trivializing the feelings we have when we look at something that almost anybody would agree is wrong. I mean, suppose it was the last day on Earth. Suppose it's not going to matter to anyone whether this kid has psychological trauma or not. Because he's not going to grow up, and neither are we. It's the world of melancholy, and we know that a planet is going to hit our planet, and we're sitting there on the lawn. I'm Kirsten Dunst sitting there alone with this child. There's a right way for her to treat that child, and it's not to torture it. It's to make it feel better. How can anyone deny that? Isn't there something objectively right about that case?
Well, see, this is an interesting thing. I'm willing to agree with you very strongly that this is a bad thing to do. What I'm not willing to do is to say that it's objectively binding.
So see, we've got this interesting dilemma. The theist starts with the feeling that there's an objective right and wrong. Right? They have John's gut feeling. And they think, I can't explain that unless I appeal to something like an objective moral universe, and where could that possibly be? It's not just nature mucking around.
There must be the author of it, who just as he authors the laws of physics, authors the laws of morality. And an atheist like Kant, well, he's not really an atheist, but a secularist philosopher like Kant says, well, we're not going to appeal to God. We got to appeal to something that gets us that feeling of objectivity and absolute bindingness, but we can't do it with God. So he's trying to tie one hand behind his back. You're not quite like Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, but you're kind of giving up a lot of stuff. You're willing to give up the thought that, yeah, that's objectively required of me to respect that child. You're willing to give that up, that there's an objective, inescapable requirement on you.
I don't think we lose much from this. I think instead, by saying it's subjective, I can take into viewpoint the view of a utilitarian, and I can also take a Rawlsian perspective, and I can also consider a Kantian view. And I don't have to say that one of these views is right and the other ones are wrong. I can say that each one of these views points out something very important and something valuable, and well, that's their value.
Well, let's think about the word objective. So it seems to me it's possible to believe in objective moral truth without believing that one theory, Rawls or Kant or Mill, is objectively right. I'm an objectivist if I think, well, there may be a lot of theories that are equally right, but there are some theories that are just plain wrong. And you may be a lot of good contenders for the best ethical theory, and maybe there's no God or nothing to decide between them. I mean, it's like physics. People believe in the theory of relativity, but there were some who said, well, you know, if you do the mathematics different and if you have some more complications over here, you can account for everything without giving up Newton's principles. Okay.
Minkowski, so maybe the space-time.
Yeah, maybe there's no objective right view, but there's 1,000 objective wrong views, right? Any theory that says when two billiard balls collide, they will never have an opposite and equal attraction, but they will both turn into mermaids and swim in the same direction, is just plain wrong. And it seems to me any theory that says torturing children for no reason, it's just plain objectively wrong. Now, do you really, I mean, forget about God.
I don't. So,
you really want to deny that?
Yeah, I do. So I think you make a great point. So the word objectively means without regard to human opinion. So it seems to me just bluntly impossible to start talking about morality without asking about human opinion. As soon as you've introduced human opinion into the analysis, we're now talking about subjective opinions. Even if, imagine if we could get total consensus from every human being that had ever lived that they don't want to be tortured for 7 days and then murdered. That might be universally something that every human being thinks. It might even be something every rational being would think. But it doesn't make it objectively true. What it does is it makes it something that all of us think is a very good idea, and we come to that from very different opinions, and all of those are good for
you. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about morality in a godless world in front of a live audience at Annenberg Auditorium on the Stanford campus, and we've got questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, I'm Gabriel from San Jose, California, and actually the question sort of had to do with exactly what was just said. What if morality comes from maybe a psychological point, it's just something in our head that we kind of evolved with. And apart from maybe a few exceptions, like a psychopath or something, humanity generally might have a point of view of what's good or bad. But what's to say that's not valid as objective? I mean, just because once humans are wiped out from existence, doesn't mean there wasn't some sort of objectivity.
Let me try something here. Thanks for the question. I think I've got the gist of the issue you're raising. So look, here's something about human beings. They have, let's call it a moral instinct, a moral sense. You won't find a human being, except, as the gentleman said, as psychopaths, who don't raise the question, what ought I to do? What ought I to believe? How ought I to feel? What can others do to me? I mean, human beings raise that question for themselves. They raise that question to each other. So it's something about human psyche. Maybe we're evolved to do this. Other creatures that we know of don't do this. Okay, there's something about the human psyche that makes us, I like to call it, more norm-mongering creatures, right? Okay, that's psychological. That's subjective. That's part of. But the answers we give, they don't seem just, they're just arbitrary and made up, right? They seem to be like
Well, John, any moral system that permitted the torturing of babies, we'd say, gee,
yeah,
there's something wrong with that one. I mean, you know. So it's not just a whim. It's not just arbitrary. It's not just cultural variation.
Sure. So
it's not just anything goes with morality.
Of course not. And that's because ultimately these systems are based on what people don't want. And people have broadly aligned interests. No one wants to be murdered. No one wants to be tortured. These are all things that we share in common. They're not objectively true, but we enshrine them in law, which is basically the closest thing you can get to objective morals.
I mean, nobody wants to be murdered, but lots of people want to murder.
Really? Oh, I thought only psychopaths wanted to murder.
No, lots of people.
Or angry people.
Lots of people want to murder. Lots of people want conquest. How do you think all the people of African descent got to the Americas? Because they were taken.
Sure.
And put over here against their will and made to be slaves because people needed their labor.
And how much help was objective morality in stopping that? In fact, at the time that that was happening, it was happening under the auspices of objective morality when people would use the Bible to defend slavery, which it does at length in the book.
Well, so you won't find much argument with me on the possible misuses of the Bible, but so you say that objectivity requires freedom from human opinions, okay? In that sense, morality is clearly not objective.
Right.
However, it is what we might call intersubjective.
Yes.
That is to say, there is widespread agreement if you pick your cases right. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, even if you find people that are in favor of torturing children, you usually find that it's because of some strange belief they have that makes the situation much different than we do, who just look at it as a case of torturing children. So if we could find principles that were intersubjectively commanded human assent, wouldn't that require some explanation? And wouldn't that be practically as good as objectivity? It'd be like maybe instead of a dollar, you have a euro, but it's almost as good.
Sure. This is something that Sam Harris has talked about in some of his books, about the need to build an intercivilizational view of morality, that we're increasingly becoming a globalized society, and we need to develop a system of morality that's as true if you're in China as if you're in Baghdad, as if you're in Palo Alto, California. And I think that this project of trying to build a coherent value system based on our lowest common denominator of moral systems is a good idea. It's what Sam Harris refers to as the moral landscape of eliminating bad ideas, but not having to say that there's one correct idea.
Welcome to Philosophy Talks here.
Hi. Yeah, I agree that morality is subjective. If there was an objective morality, wouldn't it be predictable if it does evolve, which obviously morality does evolve? You could have some sort of predictive model that you'd develop that would be pretty accurate, I guess.
Well, wait a minute. Scientific theories evolve. Aristotle started out believing in the four, you know, his Aristotelian causes in earth, air, fire, and water were the fundamental elements, and he didn't believe in, he didn't understand inertia. Descartes, Newton, Galileo, that's not the right order, Einstein, quantum theory. Scientific theory involves, but what it involves, what happens is we get a better and better understanding of the objective order of the world. Maybe morality is like that too. It evolves because our understanding of the moral universe gets better and better and better. Why not?
Are you saying earth, air, fire, and water? There's a fifth? What's the fifth? Phlegm. Well, oh, I remember. Phlegm, yeah. Was so, discovered,
I mean,
in the Middle Ages.
I mean, what's
dark matter.
What's this say? Why deny that we get a better and better understanding of the objective moral universe in the same way that we get a better and better understanding of the objective physical universe?
Because I think that we just discussed before that it wouldn't be objective still. If we want to call it maximally intersubjective or something like that, then I agree with you.
No, look. When white slave owners saw black Africans as less fully deserving, it wasn't that they had a different but inadequate or something, not practical morality that needed. They had a false morality. They had a false understanding of the moral universe.
But look, some people say, well, physics isn't objective either because, look, all physical theory ultimately relies on human reactions to experimental situations, that is, the gathering of data. And all gathering of data relies on the assumption that if a number of people look at the same thing, look at the same measuring devices, their opinions of what's measured will converge within some margin of error. So all theory, even theory that we take to be a theory of what's objectively real or not, has to be based on human reactions to situations. Why is morality different?
There's a slight difference here in that I think that we can still know objective facts about the world using science. I don't think that necessarily we're committed to a subjectivist view there. And the reason is that scientists, when they are doing these experiments, they can agree on what would count as data, and they can agree on what procedures they would follow in order to perform this. When we're talking about morality, we can't. We can't get a utilitarian and a Kantian and a Rawlsian to agree about what the ultimate nature of morality is. They each have their own subjective opinion,
and they focus on that. Don gave you an example. Torturing babies. There are different moral theories, but here's a datum. People hate being tortured. Right. People hate being exploited. Now, our moral theory has to make sense of that. Well, they're wrong, they don't deserve, right? But no, there are kind of fundamental intuitions about
I mean, you
right
guys are quite young, but I knew Kant, and I knew Mill. And I knew Rawls, and those guys did not believe in torturing babies.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about morality in a godless world with John Figdor, a humanist chaplain here at Stanford. He's co-author of Atheist Mind, Humanist Heart, Rewriting the Ten Commandments for the 21st Century.
In our final segment, we'll take on the challenge of moral disagreement. Not that we haven't been already. When there's no transcendent moral authority, to whom do we turn to settle our moral disagreements?
We're coming to you from Annenberg Auditorium on the Stanford University campus. We'll take more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our live musical guests, the Playtones, showing us that with regard to music, there are certain objective truths. The doo-wop music of my youth is just superior to the kind of things that later generations know and love. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything, and I'm John Perry.
Except your intelligence, and I'm Kent Taylor. Our guest is the humanist chaplain here at Stanford, John Figdor, and we're thinking about morality in a godless world, and we'll start on the side of the room and go back and forth. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, Roy from Palo Alto. Great conversation, but as I suppose many people in this room also feel, I think we've given religion way too much of a pass in this focus on objectivity versus subjectivity. They are every bit as subjective as what they claim the atheists are. First of all, look, let's not even get into whether God with a lowercase or capital G exists. That's for other shows and other times, but let's assume it exists. Then they then have to prove that their particular version of the Bible is the enlightened word of this God. And then they have to somehow show that their particular interpretation of it is also correct. Otherwise, there's really no difference between them and the Westboro Baptist people, Boko Haram, ISIS, et cetera, et cetera.
No, we're not, you're right. I mean, but we're not really examining the religious foundation of morality. We're just examining whether our really goal was with John to explore the conditional, if God is dead, then everything is permitted, right? Does that really follow? So we're assuming God is dead, right? So we're not, and the, what follows? Can we have objective morality
for
or not?
For the sake of argument, for the sake of argument.
But that's true. We could do a whole show on whether, I'll just say it frankly, John gave the Euthyphro dilemma. It's pretty decisive against the divine command theory of morality. There's some arguments back and forth, but God doesn't help.
Well, we could have Bob Adams on here, and he'd be a pretty hard time.
We could have a whole show about that, but we're not really. You're right. We're giving religion a pass because we're trying to focus on atheism. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, this is Mete from Mountain View. So very much my point is going to be in line with yours. Since the God itself is not objective, if there are multiple gods. So trying to find an objective morality across multiple gods doesn't make any sense at all, right? So before you get to finding an ultimate morality and tying it to a god.
Well, but this is for you.
They're all on my side.
This is, no, I know.
I mean,
this is for you. This is for you and for you. Look, I'm the child about to be abused or exploited or something. Put yourself in that. I want to cry out to the universe, to my exploiter or abuser, this is wrong. You stop. Don't do this to me. And I don't want that just to be my cry. I want the world to be on my side because it's so that you are not to do that to me. You guys are saying there's no authority there that's on your side. It's just a bunch of human subjectivity and you just want that. Is that what you really believe? That there's that there's no objective stop on you?
I think that misunderstands the position, which is we say anyone who's thinking rightly would look at that young man's position and say, wow, we don't want that to happen.
Thinking rightly. What's a rightly? Where's that come
yeah,
from?
Yeah, where does that come from?
Does that mean correctly?
Oh, sorry. I mean someone who's not a psychopath. A psychopath might see someone torturing a child and think, hey, my turn next. I'm talking about someone who's not, you know, working with
disrupted... You're talking about Kantian reason or something?
In the broadest sense, you know, rational in the simplest sense we mean.
So let's put the objectivity aside. Suppose I think, yeah, there's no objective truth about God. And maybe there's no objective truth about morality. But still, the two go together, even subjectively. If I'm going to devote my life to something, if I'm going to risk my life for something, if I'm going to put all my efforts into something because I believe it's wrong, and we want people to do this, and you as a chaplain want to, whatever you do as a chaplain, chapel to these people.
Chapels.
I mean, Kant had the moral argument for God, which had several facets, but one of them is, how can you have the will to follow up on your moral feelings, the most important feelings in the world, what separates us from dumb animals, what's right and wrong, unless you feel that there's something beyond you that makes them right or wrong. So do you have an answer to that? Does Sam Harris have an answer to that? Oh, well, it'd be a good thing for humanity if we all agreed, so let's pick something and agree on it. That's not going to do it. That's not going to get me to lay my life in the front of a bulldozer to get somebody to vote or to free a slave.
Sure, I don't understand what subjectivity makes you lose in terms of this. So a mother who loves her child is still going to do all of those moral obligations that she has to her child, regardless of whether she thinks they're objectively binding or not. Mm-hmm. I'm not understanding what the objective basis
because,
adds
no, to no, I mean, I'm abstracting from objectivity. I say that God and morality go together.
Except for all the times they don't, for all the abortion clinic bombers, or for all the people who have persecuted gay people in California under Prop 8, no. Or, for example, the rape of children in the
but
Roman Catholic Church.
But wait a minute,
Catholic
why
Church?
Don't they go together? If you're an abortion bomber, you're going out there risking your life because you're thinking that people are killing the souls of unborn folk, and that's wrong, and it's so wrong that even though it's illegal, even though you're going to get in trouble, even though people are going to hate you, even though Jon Stewart's going to make fun of you, you've got to do it. And why do you have to do it? Because right. It's right. And why is it right? Because some authority says it's right.
So this is one of the dangers.
And if you're trying to fight that guy, you have the same beliefs. But if we say, well, you're going to have your morality, but leave God out of it, are we going to have anybody that's impassioned about doing anything right or wrong?
I would say yes. If we look at the governments that actually donate the most money to humanitarian causes, they're the secular socialist democracies of Northern Europe and Scandinavia.
The ones that have the most money.
No, I mean, we have the most money in China, if we're talking about that. But the point is, they actually do way more. And if we look for societies that are more secular, more atheist, like I had these stats earlier, are actually less or more peaceful, less violent, less racist. All these statistics are provided by Phil Zuckerman of Pitzer College from just downstate.
Let's list some of our listeners. Welcome to Wolf Duck, sir.
Thank you. Mikhail, formerly from Soviet Union. I think man pursues certainty. Every society we know always had a priest or somebody holder of an absolute truth. And that is because man needs somebody who knows everything and hence it reflects on a fact, on a need of an absolute truth, objective truth. You know, there are no societies which, can you imagine any society to develop where there was no set of rules which would consider to be objective?
So,
and out of this context, you cannot continue this conversation.
Well, so
well,
I'm gonna throw Nietzsche in here, because you're having kind of a Nietzschean thought, maybe. I'm not sure. Nietzsche says, up until now, morality has not been a problem. We've never questioned it. It's rather been that hallowed place of peace where all disputes come to an end, where our thinkers could take a rest even from themselves, right? So morality is this thing. That's how we pretended it was, which settles all dispute. Am I to do this or am I not? Well, morality says you can do that. You must do this. You must not do that. It gives you, and there's no disputing it. He says, that's an illusion. There's no such thing, right? There's no such thing. There's no hallowed place of peace. Now, here's the thing now he was courageous. He said, oh, people who believe in objective morality in the absence of God, they're just living in the shadow of God. They're just pretending, right? They're just pretending. Kant is the biggest pretender ever, according to Nietzsche, right? And you know what it sounds like to me? You think you can have your cake and eat it too. You think you can have, there's no objective morality that settles all these disputes, but I can have peace and harmony and all that poppycock. If there's no objective morality that settles all these truths, there's just what I said in the opening. There's a cacophony of human opinion. Reason, this thing you said, oh, right-thinking people, there's no one way that right-thinking people think. They think all kinds of different ways. Some are communists, some are fascists, some are this, some are that. Right, so there's no peace if there's no objective morality.
But how does adding God into this situation solve the problem?
He's the guy who gives the answer.
Who's God? It's a bankrupt version of God, right?
That's true.
So the problem that we have is that someone from ISIS would say, my God tells me to do this. And then a Unitarian Universalist pastor from Harvard Divinity School would say, are you crazy?
No, I don't think you understand. I'm giving you the Nietzschean line. Let's grant there is no God.
Sure.
Nietzsche agrees with Dostoevsky. We give up on God. We give up on this transcendent authority that can settle things. And what is there? There is the cacophony of human diversity, working itself out, struggle, turmoil, not peace, but struggle.
But weren't you just telling me about great cases of consensus and how we can all agree that we don't want to be murdered?
I'm doing the other side.
And we don't want to be tortured? Sounds like you're having it both ways.
I'm just playing my role here. I'm pushing you from left and from right.
It's good. Yeah,
but wouldn't Nietzsche agree that quite apart from religion or God, there's torturing babies is something?
No, he wouldn't.
He wouldn't?
No. He doesn't think there's anything that has any moral authority of us outside of me. He rejects that. He thinks you're only going to get that if you're deluded, and it's a shadow of God, and you've got to give up that shadow.
But he was a psychopath.
Well, yeah. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, I'm Jacob from Ventura County, and I'm reading Spinoza's Theological Political Treatise. So I'm curious. So he equates God with nature, right. And he also comes to the conclusion that you should love God and love other people. Of course, God is nature. So I'm just curious if Spinoza has anything to add to this discussion on whether or not you can base morality on God.
What do you think?
I actually love Spinoza because my good friend Rebecca Goldstein at Harvard wrote a book about Spinoza, and he turns out to be a really interesting figure to non-religious people because he was someone who was thrown out of his religious community for having too heretodoxical views. He was too much of a heretic for his community to tolerate. So we think of him as someone who said, look, I'm going to follow reason where reason leads me, and if that means that my community is going to excommunicate me and kick me out, so be it. I'm willing to pursue the truth. And that's why I think Spinoza is such an influential figure to so many atheists and non-religious people.
So, John, this has been a great conversation. We just scratched the surface. I wish we could go on, but I've got to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Hey, John. Hey, John.
Our guest has been John Figdor, a humanist chaplain here at Stanford, and co-author of Atheist Mind, Humanist Heart, Rewriting the Ten Commandments for the 21st Century. We didn't ask him how he would rewrite those things, John. So what are you thinking? You want to rewrite the Ten Commandments or what?
No, I don't think so. I think they're fine the way they are. Maybe there should be a couple footnotes, like a definition of adultery.
So what's your closing thought here?
I think Kant, who you like better than it came across in this thing, said the two things that are so impressive are the moral law within and the starry heavens above. And the crisis in my life, what leads to my melancholy, is the fact that I think the starry heavens above are just a joke. I mean, they go on forever and ever and ever, light years of dust and crap. And if there are intelligent beings out there, we'll never know. They have nothing. No, they don't. We're alone in a universe, and it turns out to be huge, and that doesn't do much for me. How about the moral law within? Jesus, it's about as messy as the starry heavens. So Kant was onto something, but what I get out of it is depression.
Well, Kant was onto something, but so was Nietzsche. We've got this urge that there be this hallowed place of peace. We've got this deep human urge that there be an objective moral order. But I personally think it's really hard to make that urge good, and probably we should abandon it and then live with the consequences, which makes it very, very complicated. But, you know, this is a conversation.
I'm as sure that it's wrong to torture babies as I am that there's a hand in front of my face.
Well, yeah, but that could be wrong, too. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's hear about morality in a world without speed limits. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, here in the ever scarier 21st century, you'd think with the rise of atheism, doubt, fear, skepticism, cynicism, spoiled, awful children, and the relentless high self-regard of the baby boomers, Generation X, and millennials, come to think of it, all Americans in general, we'd be neck deep in a moral swamp and sinking. Well, if you believe in the culture war, we are. Maybe it's because I live in the California Bay Area, but I have a hard time taking the culture war seriously. You know, there's a war on Christmas, says some guy on Fox News. I thought Christmas won that. I know I surrendered. You got me, Christmas, I said. But instead of killing me, Christmas gave me a pair of socks. Thank you, Christmas. What a gracious enemy. Now, the movie American Sniper is supposed to be another culture war flashpoint. Lefties, who seem to have forgotten that we've had war movies before, hold American Sniper as alarming evidence of America's turn towards fascism. The right, who also seem to have forgotten that they saw Rambo way back when, hold American Sniper as evidence that America is finally starting to feel pride again. The straightforward sniping back and forth about the movie is a bit refreshing, actually, in the context of the new Twitter-shaming epidemic epitomized by the ongoing Bill Cosby drama. Not a day goes by without some Facebook poster getting all outraged about some new accusation by some new accuser. This has been going on for a while now. I have to wonder, what is the point? Is Bill Cosby going to be arrested and put on trial? Why? Because the blogosphere is outraged? Doubtful, the pointing and tongue-clucking seem themselves to be the punishment. Take that, Bill Cosby. On the other hand, the big fear from the religious right that we will all succumb to situational ethics does not seem to have happened. Well, it has, but every situation is an ethical situation for somebody, for everybody. Stop vaccines because their children will get autism. Vaccinate everybody with measles. Feminists are ruining video games. Video gamers are threatening feminists. Obamacare is evil. Obamacare saves lives. We won Iraq. We lost Iraq. You're a hypocrite. Without hypocrisy, nothing will get done. No more slut shaming. No more gender insults. No more fat shaming. We're on the lookout for powerful hashtags. Hashtag, has Justine landed yet? Hashtag, stand with Wendy. Hashtag, Paula's best dishes. Remember those? How quickly the Twitterati forget. I do not doubt that social media does some social good in raising awareness and bearing witness. On the other hand, hashtag Je suis Charlie. Really? Are you really Charlie? Or just another self-righteous poser with a smartphone? But who am I to judge? My cisgen white privilege is showing. Hashtag haters gotta hate, man. Hashtag I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Eric Westfall, Orgelzau, Erica Topit, Dan Brandon, and Crystal Nickerson.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners in our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed, or sometimes misexpressed, in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website. That's philosophytalk.org. There you can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.